From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as the town of West picks up the pieces and honors its heroes, others wonder why the explosion happened at all and how to prevent more. Former President George W. Bush cuts the ribbon on his presidential library, but will the archive try to rewrite history or preserve it? And the San Saba River, once a dependable spring-fed stream, ranchers there now say it needs a water master to save it from environmental disaster.
We want to bring in a sheriff to just enforce and keep the peace on the river.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Thursday, thousands in Waco mourned the first responders who died in the fire and explosion of the fertilizer plant in the town of West. Family, friends, and supporters were quietly moved by the speakers, but loudly embraced President Obama there with the First Lady. KERA Dallas Public Radio reporter Bill Zeeble was there.
There were common heartfelt themes in Thursday's memorial for the 10 fallen firefighters and two EMS workers. One, Amazing Grace, played by uniformed bagpipers. Senate Minority Whip John Cornyn shared another theme, that these volunteers were heroes.
When the call went out for help, these men, along with countless others in West, ran immediately toward the danger. Not away from it, they ran toward it, looking for a way they might help.
Cornyn introduced President Barack Obama to the packed arena that also included hundreds of firefighters and emergency workers from across Texas and the nation. The senator thanked the president and first lady for being there, and the crowd stood as Mr. Obama sounded another theme of this memorial, community.
Thank you.
He started by saying that while the eyes of a nation may have been fixed this past week on Boston, Americans' hearts were also here.
And to the families and neighbors grappling with unbearable loss, we are here to say you are not alone. You are not forgotten. We may not all live here in Texas, but we're neighbors too. We're Americans too, and we stand with you, and we do not forget. And we'll be there even after the cameras leave.
Obama said few non-Texans likely ever heard of West, but now they know the small town is solid, familiar, and true, where residents look after each other. He said instead of changing who you are, this tragedy simply reveals who you've always been.
We need people who so love their neighbors as themselves that they're willing to lay down their lives for them. America needs towns like West. That's what makes this country great, is towns like West.
Governor Perry praised the first responders as people who know there's no such thing as a routine emergency. The stories of those who died, like that of Kenneth Lucky Harris, he said, are inspiring and heartbreaking.
There's the Dallas fire captain who was off duty, but who responded anyway because his community was threatened.
It was the Dallas Fire Department that carried out an old tradition, sounding a bell for each fallen firefighter.
Captain Kenneth Lucky Harris, Dallas Fire Department.
Taps was played. A folded American flag and a helmet were presented to each family. Bishop Joe Vasquez gave the benediction. Bill Zeeble, KERA News.
It's estimated that the explosion in West did over $100 million in damages to the town. It's not clear who's liable for that. Some say it falls to the owner of the West fertilizer plant, which stored the volatile chemicals had exploded, and there's a growing paper trail of apparent negligence. Others say it's the regulator's fault for not doing a better job of keeping tabs on the fertilizer company, even after failed past inspections and violations. Keith Wrightson is a worker safety and health advocate for Public Citizen. He says it's still yet to be determined who's to blame, but lack of government oversight and weak regulation played a role in the deadly catastrophe.
We know that regulations and sensible safeguards can be put in place to protect the public from disasters and also the disaster that happened at West. One example of that would be regulations or, you know, building code provisions, perhaps sprinklers or fire suppression systems. It's still not clear to me if those types of measures were in place in that facility. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration would also have something to say about that. Perhaps fire extinguishers, signage, administrative controls such as product labeling and worker training could have averted this this horrible disaster.
The first thing we have to realize in order to prevent these types of disasters is to realize that they can be prevented.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They can be prevented.
So that disaster at West should never have happened.
I suppose it should never have happened. I mean, there's you know, problems with every system of control, so that's for sure. But there's no doubt that rules and guidance can help mitigate these problems steer us from horrible situations such as this.
So what needs to be done to make sure that workers are put first and profit second?
I mean, some of the things that are going on presently in Washington, D.C., we have seen federal budgets slashed due to the sequester. And that is a problem in itself. It affects a lot of agencies, such as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It also affects the EPA, and it affects the million, you know, just about every government agency. During this anti-regulatory, anti-government spending climate, the plan just to have across-the-board cuts is not necessarily a good idea. We're going to see a diminished capacity of OSHA, particularly, and that's concerning because the agency is already strapped for resources. Presently, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has about 2,200 inspectors. After they furlough employees due to the sequester, you can expect, you know, roughly 200 less inspectors on the job. And that's not good for America's workplaces. Presently, it would take the agency, OSHA, 130 years to inspect each workplace once in the nation. In Texas, particularly, it would take them 98 years to inspect each workplace in Texas once. So I find that deeply troubling, considering we know that inspections can save lives.
Also on Thursday, the George W. Bush Presidential Library was dedicated in Dallas. The two-term former president was honored by fellow former presidents, including his father. As per tradition, the sitting president, Barack Obama, was there also and praised his predecessor.
This is a Texas-sized party, and that's worthy of what we're here to do today, honor the life and legacy of the 43rd president of the United States, George W. Bush. When all the living former presidents are together, it's also a special day for our democracy. We've been called the world's most exclusive club, and we do have a pretty nice clubhouse. But the truth is, our club's more like a support group. The last time we all got together was just before I took office, and I needed that because, as each of these leaders will tell you, no matter how much you may think you're ready to assume the office of the presidency, it's impossible to truly understand the nature of the job until it's yours, until you're sitting at that desk. And that's why every president gains a greater appreciation for all of those who served before them, for the leaders from both parties who've taken on the momentous challenges and felt the enormous weight of a nation on their shoulders. And for me, that appreciation very much extends to President Bush. Now, the first thing I found in that desk the day I took office was a letter from George, and one that demonstrated his compassion and his generosity. For he knew that I would come to learn what he had learned, that being president above all is a humbling job.
The Bush presidency certainly saw its share of challenges, as we hear in an audio montage from KUT reporter Nathan Bernier.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
George W. Bush has barely sharpened the pencils in the Oval Office, and already the press has turned into a blunt instrument.
Saddled with an image in the popular mind, nurtured by the media, that he's a big, goofy dope.
Yeah, I'm afraid that that's set in stone.
Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
I couldn't feel stronger, David, that this is a time for us, and I'm not preaching about it. George Bush is the president. He makes the decisions. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where.
Iraqi officials deny accusations of ties with Al-Qaeda. These denials are simply not credible.
Fortunately, we have an independent media in this country who would tell us the truth.
The rallying around the president, around the flag, and around the troops clearly has begun.
I just want you to know, I think Navy SEALs rock.
The majority of Americans now support an invasion of Iraq.
So powerful is this force which is building out here in the desert. It is bold, it is audacious, it is fast, and it is traveling far.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
TV channels throughout the Arab world are showing still photographs of what appear to be Iraqi prisoners being abused by American soldiers.
Those responsible for these abuses have caused harm that goes well beyond the walls of a prison.
We've received word that Senator John Kerry intends to concede the presidential race.
I earned capital in the campaign, political capital, and now I intend to spend it.
Let me talk about Social Security.
The city of New Orleans is bracing for a huge Category 5 hurricane.
Again, I want to thank you all for, and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
We've been hearing politicians on television saying, you know, well, I understand your frustration. And a man came up to me the other day and said, you know what, people aren't frustrated here, people are dead.
Harriet Myers currently serves as White House counsel.
One of the most interesting ideas I heard was, why don't you pick somebody who hasn't been a judge?
Look, how is she going to contribute to this? She has no track record.
Earlier today, she withdrew her nomination.
A 5-count indictment against I. Lewis Libby.
It's not a question of whether or not I'd like to talk more about this. I think I've indicated to you all that I'd be glad to talk about this once this process is complete.
Your credibility and his credibility is not on criminal trial, but it may very well be on trial with the American public.
And only about a third of Americans approve the way President Bush is handling his job.
Another Hurricane Katrina. That's how the New York Times' Paul Krugman describes the scandal surrounding the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and he is absolutely right.
The growing tide, especially among Senate Republicans, of defecting from his war strategy.
So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
A lot of people are telling me that in Washington, they're not really embracing the true magnitude of what some people say is happening in the economy.
And these firms are going to go out of business, and he's nuts! They're nuts! They know nothing!
Stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
There's also the onset of what may be only the grisliest recession anyone can remember.
Do you think, in retrospect, that you have made any mistakes? And if so, what is the single biggest?
Clearly, putting a mission accomplished on an aircraft carrier was a mistake. Abu Ghraib obviously was a huge disappointment, not having weapons of mass destruction.
That was a strange use of logic.
It wasn't just a disappointment. It was a catastrophe, given what the justification was for going in.
I wish you all the very best. I wish you and your families all the best. God bless you.
That was an audio montage from KUT Austin reporter Nathan Bernier, taking us through 8 years of the George W. Bush presidency in less than 4 minutes. Also at the Bush Library dedication Thursday was National Politico reporter James Hoffman.
It's a uniquely American moment in democracy, when all of our former presidents, five presidents, the current one and the four previous ones are all coming together. I was on the campaign trail last year and saw Barack Obama continue to criticize President Bush and blame Bush for a lot of the country's continuing problems. And it was quite something to see him at this event praising Bush as a good man, someone who he appreciates the challenges that he faced now that he is president. And there's something cathartic and very unique about that. And it really is an opportunity for George Bush to rehabilitate his image, to to introduce himself on his terms. I think every president gets a second look from voters at some point. New poll shows approval ratings about 47%, up from 33% when he left office. And he's kept a pretty low profile for the last 4 years. And what we saw in the dedication ceremony and in the new museum, which is also opening, is how he wants to be remembered. He was active and hands-on in designing this museum and the exhibits and the specific words on some of the panels. And it's clear he wants to be remembered as someone who pushed for democracy overseas, education reform, and tax cuts at home. And that's the image that Bush wants people to remember him by.
Barack Obama there doing the dedication, you couldn't help but think that he was thinking about when he gets his library.
Absolutely. There is a fight going on between Hawaii and University of Chicago over who will get the Obama library. Chicago is almost certain to, and I'm 100% sure Obama today was thinking that the next time one of these things opens, it's going to be his library. How is he going to be remembered? What's his legacy going to be? What are people going to be focusing on in 6 years when his project opens?
Is the library supposed to be an objective presentation of what happened during his years, or is it supposed to be favorable towards the president?
Bush tries hard to have credibility. So he addresses issues like Hurricane Katrina and the financial crisis, but it's not objective. It is on Bush's terms. Bush wrote the language. It makes Bush look good or look like he was doing his best with the available information that he had to make the decisions that he did. Over time, these presidential shrines tend to become more neutral and objective. Richard Nixon's presidential library didn't reckon in a serious way with Watergate until 2011. Ronald Reagan's presidential library opened in 1991, but it didn't add anything about Iran-Contra until 2011. And so that gives you a sense of the way that these museums work. It's all Bush loyalists who are involved in designing the exhibits. And now that the Bush people built the museum, they've turned it over to the National Archives, which is a taxpayer-funded federal agency, to administer it. But the Bush loyalists ultimately get to design and control the exhibit space.
There's been a lot of chitter-chatter between the right and the left. The lefties don't want to let go of some of the things that George W. Bush did that have been kind of dragging down the Republican Party. And so they're using this as an opportunity to remind people that, and they think that the library should do their work for them.
Absolutely. And there's tension in the library, in the exhibits. For example, there's a big section on Bush expanding Medicare and adding the prescription drug benefit, which is something that's generally popular but is not at all popular with conservatives who see it as sort of big government republicanism and are angry that Bush grew the deficit and a bunch of things that they don't think were very conservative while he was president. But the Bush folks aren't worried about winning over their base with this museum. They're thinking about long-term legacy.
James Hoffman is the national political reporter for Politico.com. He covered the dedication of the George W. Bush Presidential Library in Dallas. The San Saba River is not a mighty river, but it's dependable. It's located in central Texas along the northern edge of the Edwards Plateau, and it drains into the Texas-Colorado River, or at least it does when it doesn't go dry, which happens more and more frequently. So often that the San Saba was recently named one of the most endangered rivers in the nation by the conservation group American Rivers. The group ranked the San Saba third on the list for the most endangered rivers and says it's threatened by excessive water use by landowners and irrigators. This is putting a hurt on downstream ranchers like Griff Thomas.
My family's ranch is on the San Saba River. We've been in the ranching business there for several generations. The San Saba River runs right through the middle of our ranch.
So I imagine in previous generations, the river was pretty much dependable, except during tough times.
The river's always been dependable. It's never, even in tough times, it's a spring-fed river that never stops running until about the last decade where withdrawal of water upriver from us now takes more water than the river can afford to lose, and the river quits running. But as far as anybody knows in recorded history and geology data, the river has run for forever until Even, you know, like even during the 1950s drought, the river never stopped running. But now, for the last day, over a decade now, the river stops running every year when the irrigation interest upriver in the Menard area start taking too much water out of the river.
Who's taking the water?
Mostly agricultural interests, some personal interest up in Menard County. They've built a dam. They have a canal dug that diverts water away from the river. They have illegal pumps. I don't know if you're sure about if you're knowledgeable on the Texas water rights. It's a very antiquated system in Texas that depends on voluntary compliance, which is not being done.
Well, in times like these, when water is getting more and more precious every day, voluntary compliance doesn't seem like it's a way to run a river.
Well, that's the way it's done in Texas.
And what does this mean to the ranch?
Well, our ranch now goes for months. In the last 2 years, it's gone about 6 months without any water in the river. We have the pastures that we use along the river. That's their sole source of water. So during those times, we can no longer, run our cattle in those areas. It's been devastating on the environment. We used to have vast numbers of native pecan trees along the river. Most of them have died and are gone. We have very few left. It's just played havoc on the environment and on our ranching interest. And not to say what it's probably done to the land values in the area. We haven't sold any of our ranch, so we don't know, but I can imagine what effect it's going to have on that.
So have you talked to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality and told them that they need to do some sort of enforcement?
Yes, sir. We've been very active in trying to get the TCEQ to take a more, active duties, and since there are already laws that exist to enforce water rights and to restrict withdrawal of water, they haven't been very good at enforcing that, and basically tell us they don't have the resources to enforce it.
Griff Thomas is a Texas rancher who depends on the flow of the San Saba River, which is frequently going dry. He says the river needs a water master. Water is also a point of friction between Texas and our northern neighbor, Oklahoma. On Tuesday, the cross-state water skirmish went to the U.S. Supreme Court. As KERA's Shelley Koffler reports, the state of Oklahoma and the Tarrant Regional Water District in Fort Worth are arguing over water rights.
Just below Hugo Lake, the fish are jumping.
Right today, I'm going to try to catch some catfish. We caught some last night.
A healthy spring rain has filled the lake, so the Army Corps of Engineers has opened the floodgates at the dam, releasing a thunderous rush of water into the Kiamichi River. Along the riverbanks, anglers stand shoulder to shoulder. Linnell Webster says it doesn't get any better than this for the rod and reel crowd.
This is what we're catching here, 14, 16-inch crappie.
A good eat?
Oh, delicious.
This is a way of life for Oklahoma natives like Webster, which is why he's pretty hot about a Texas plan to buy some of the water rolling past his fishing hole.
No. N-O.
Why?
Because it's going to take this away from us here, and they're going to drain that lake up there.
You don't think there's enough to go around?
No. That lake was dry this past winter, and we generally have water in it. But no, that is a no-no.
It's true, this past winter was unusually dry around Hugo. But since 2008, Hugo has averaged 10 to 15 more inches of rain each year than its Texas neighbors in Fort Worth. And Oklahoma's rural population doesn't begin to use it all, which is why the Tarrant Regional Water District in Fort Worth sees no problem with its plan to build a pump station in Oklahoma, several miles downstream from the Lake Hugo Dam. The Tarrant District would capture the clear mountain water before it hits the Red River and mixes with salty minerals that are expensive to extract. Then they'd ship the water through a 125-mile pipeline to North Texas.
We feel that that's our right under the compact to obtain that water. We have a right to it, and when there's a right, there's a remedy.
That's Jim Oliver, the executive director of the Tarrant Regional Water District. He says the water district is just trying to enforce the Red River Compact, an agreement between Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas that Congress approved in 1980. The compact says that when the water in the Red River and its tributaries exceed a certain level, each of the states is entitled to one-fourth of the excess. What the compact doesn't explicitly say is whether you must withdraw that water within your own state. Tarrant says it's not possible to pump its full share from Texas. So in a lawsuit against Oklahoma, it claims the only way to fulfill the contract is for Texas entities to cross the state line and capture the water there.
They'll take more than their fair share. That's exactly right.
State Senator Jerry Ellis represents the southeastern corner of Oklahoma, which includes the Kiamichi Basin. The bumper sticker on his oversized pickup leaves no question where he stands. It says, "Don't sell Oklahoma water."
Well, I've always opposed selling water outside the state of Oklahoma. This is just bad policy to allow somebody to come cross-border, and the Red River Compact certainly does not allow this to happen. It does not allow another state to come over and cross-border to take water.
Senator Ellis has done his best to keep Texas out. In 2009, he co-authored laws that forbid Oklahoma water from being exported beyond its boundaries, unless the legislature gives consent, which isn't likely to happen. Three lower courts have sided with Oklahoma, and at least seven states, many with their own compacts, have filed legal briefs supporting Oklahoma. But the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to look again at what the Red River Compact guarantees and whether Oklahoma's restrictions on exporting water are legal. Jim Oliver with the Tarrant Regional Water District says North Texas has a lot riding on the decision.
It's the cheapest source of water and the most abundant source of water that we can obtain. If the area keeps growing as rapidly as it has, and we don't do anything, then that limits our growth, it limits economic development. You've got industries that aren't going to move here if there's no water supply. Those are the scary things.
Other water districts in North Texas are supporting Tarrant Water's lawsuit. So is the city of Hugo, Oklahoma, and its former city manager, David Rawls. He says selling water to Texas could bring a new standard of living to one of the poorest parts of his state.
It would produce new schools, new roads. It would produce new jobs. Our lifestyle here is rural. We enjoy it, but our children, once they finish high school, have to go someplace else to look for jobs and work because there's not a great deal of it.
Senator Ellis agrees water may be the key to improving southeastern Oklahoma's economy, but he doesn't think selling it to Texas is the answer. Ellis has been talking to Oklahoma's Chickasaw and Choctaw tribes about using the water at home.
Growth will go where the water goes. We will never have jobs here if you let the water get away. That's the key to growth. The tribes came to me in 2009 and said, hey, you're right. We want to develop the water where it is and bring jobs to southeastern Oklahoma.
Below the dam, casting for catfish, Larry Burris isn't much swayed by anyone's argument for economic development.
We sure need it, but we need the water too. If the water goes, a lot of things will go. No camping, no outside recreations at the lake.
Burris is no doubt hoping some of the justices have baited a hook or two. So when they decide who can use this water, the wildness of the river is protected too. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There's also a space to comment right there on our website at tpr.org. There were past Texas Matters programs also on the website, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.